Welcome to Chapter 4 of The Distance Between Stars, a sci-fi novelette and audio drama by Stephen Cabot. Stick around after the show for fun facts and a look at what's next. Enjoy the show.
My father gave me skills I could take anywhere. Giggling behind a girl's cabin at a summer camp in the Adirondacks. Camping on the Rio Grande. Wood smoke and the slim stalks of Ocotillo rising beyond the beached rafts. Walking out past the hotels in Florida with wet tennis shoes in my hands. And my sister swinging a flashlight over scuttling ghost crabs. At any minute, anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, I could lift my eyes up from the earth, and if Laylee wasn't arcing the beam toward my face, or I wasn't standing in a parking lot with burning white lights, I could see familiar stars. The stories were a handbook for living on the earth. I could find north by following the pointer stars on the outer edge of the Big Dipper. I could tell you when it was planting time, hunting season, harvest, the start of the spring rains, all based on the telltale constellations. I could even tell you when ghosts would rise and walk among the living, if you believe the old myths. Stars are reliable that way. They keep their promises, but they don't show you more than they have to. You could maybe catch the orange-yellow blur of Alpha Centauri just over the horizon at the right time of night around the Florida Keys. But it's a star of the Southern Hemisphere. I didn't get that lucky. Not once in 23 years before the evacuation did I see it with my own eyes. I first saw the grainy pics of the solar system when the UN authorized the fleet. Telescope snaps showed the three stars of Alpha Centauri, Rigel Centaurus, Ptolemy, and Proxima Centauri. Gravity locks Rigel and Ptolemy together into one binary star we call Alpha Centauri AB. The Loner, a small red dwarf, orbits its siblings farther out. As support for the project grew, artist sketches of planets filled the news. All the planets we know about orbit Proxima Centauri, and they take their name from the red sun. Proxima B, an Earth-sized exoplanet, our best chance. Proxima C, huge and surrounded by icy rings. Proxima D, smaller than Earth, hugging the star too close for comfort. Since the launch, I've huddled over scientists' laptops and watched projections of planetary orbits. There's one ghost planet no one's confirmed yet, caught transiting between Rigel Centaurus and our scopes. Could be a solar flare messing with the tech. Could be the exoplanet we're looking for. Either way, all the planets are in the Milky Way. If you stood on one of them and lifted your eyes, you'd see familiar stars. Only one constellation would change. Centaurus, named for Chiron, the horseman who taught medicine to the Greeks. Alpha Centauri is the foot of the constellation. You'd be right in it. Unlike other centaurs, Chiron lived a life of peace and art. But it didn't save him. Pricked by a poison arrow, condemned to suffer forever, Chiron gave up his immortality and Zeus placed him in the sky. I think a lot about what it means, living in the centaur. How we're running for the healer with our tail on fire. How we gave up our forever, all our known things, to end the suffering. How our knowledge and civilized manners may not save us either. The other centaurs were known for kidnapping women, tearing men apart, eating meat raw. They loved drunken raids and swung giant pine branches as weapons. They sound a lot like the Und. We still don't know where the aliens came from. Maybe they're one solar system over, in those guessed-at planets of Alpha Centauri. Maybe we're flying straight toward their home.
The fleet isn't just a bunch of escape pods. It's got everything we need to start over. Mining equipment, 3D printers, seed vaults, chem labs for medicines, and guns. Lots of guns. Then there's a Ceph we need to make it out of our solar system. We're easing people off the foods they knew back home. We started with canned foods and dried meats and pastas. Now we're switching to ship-grown vegetables and tofu and nutrition powder. Two levels on every ship are aeroponics. Bean sprouts, greens, dwarf wheat under grow lights. I check the growth levels myself so I can run my hands along the slim green stalks. Across from my college was a pasture, and I'd paint there in the plain air. For a moment, I'm 19 again, with a platinum streak in my hair, and anything is possible. Then, I hear the hum of the misters. The ship squeezes around me. I have to dig my nails into my palms so I can breathe. Most of the time, I'm too busy fixing numbers to think about what I lost. Every ship has 3 to 5 supply clerks, and half of them can't count. They got roped into these jobs like everyone up here. Our freaking spreadsheets are so full of holes, they look like the Und chewed them. My mom was a CPA, and she hated doing taxes. The way people lied and lost receipts, screwed up whole columns. Math is easy, baby girl, she'd say. It's people who don't add up. I told the commander that one day after he'd chewed out the head clerk for losing a whole crate of infant formula on the Montana. He just stared at me. You take after her, he said. You good with numbers? And then I wasn't a secretary anymore. Proxima Centauri b is in the Goldilocks zone, the habitable arc around a decent sun. Not enough radiation to cook us, but enough to put seeds in the ground. B rotates in sync with its star, so the same side of the planet is always daylight. The atmosphere may have burned off. Scientists are working up a plan to print reflective geodesic domes, like a summer camp in the woods. We don't know what else is waiting for us. Jungles, oceans we can swim in, bacteria that could kill us overnight, a whole civilization that heard our radio signals but decided not to write back. Sam gets so excited thinking about it. He forgets we won't live to see it. He loves second chances. Another planet, M, he'll say. Whole other planet. And then he'll trace the blue veins in my forearm down past the crisscrossed scars.
I spent every summer since I was 12 carrying 2x4s and cement blocks and PVC pipe. I held the end of the tape measure and got cussed at a lot. Being the gopher, Dad called it. Go to the corner store for some Cokes. Go to the truck and grab the plumb line. Go back for that box of wood screws I left on the trailer. Sometimes, he'd let me drive nails or lay a line of bricks, but never on the front of the house. Not until I got it perfect. Every June till August, I'd mix mortar and wear out the knees of last year's school jeans and learn a few more dirty jokes from the guys. I was supposed to go to college for business, take over the company when Dad retired. But the second wave hit before spring break, my senior year. Mrs. Eberson put it on the TV in chemistry. Caroline Bender started crying in the back, just wailing, her blonde hair over her eyes. I walked out the side hall, past the gym, and drove to the strip mall and looked out the windshield in the rain. The wiper motor used to hang up on the Silverado. It sounded like swish, drag, swish. The neon signs for the recruiters blurred through the raindrops. Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force. Sorry, ma'am. Air Force. George Strait was playing on the radio. It's funny how you remember things. My dad always said he was the last real country singer. My mom was wiping the counter down when I came inside. She folded the rag on itself too many times and set it on the stove. What did you do, Sam? She said. What did you do? And she went in the bathroom and cried. I handed my father the enlistment papers at dinner. He nodded, pushed his chair back, and said, "Come on out to the garage." He dug my grandfather's K-bar knife out of a plastic box under some greasy rags. The handguard wobbled, and the leather handle wrap was coming unglued. "See if they'll let you carry this one," he said. "It got your pops through caisson." He drove me to the bus for basic training a few weeks later, and I never saw him again. I'm supposed to be messed up from the war. That's what everybody says. PTSD, or nightmares, or something. I mean, I'm not dead inside. I saw guys chewed in half when their rifles jammed. Two of my buddies called in an airstrike too close to a hive and dusted themselves. I broke my leg in two places when a Humvee rolled. But we had a purpose, you know. How many people get to save the world? Nah, it's my mom I think about. That first night, She didn't eat a bite of spaghetti. She just pushed the noodles around her plate with the fork and chewed her lip. "At least wait until they get to Kentucky," she said. "Let somebody else go. Baby, please." She never looked me in the eyes again.
I know it sounds funny, but it's horses I miss. The filly in the springtime, galloping the length of the fence line for the hell of it. Divots of fresh mud flung every which way and the dandelions turning gold. I always lived in trailers on the edge of little towns. There was always a paint mare down the street, pushing her long neck through the loose barbed wire to get at a patch of grass, or a sorrel rolling in the weeds scratch its back. There's something right about the world with horses in it, something calm and measured in sunlight and forkloads of hay. Came to rely on the sight of them. I dated a couple of horsewomen, girls who grew up reading Black Beauty in the cool of the barn, riding bareback in jean shorts. I spent a lot of time with a shovel and muck boots and secondhand saddles and somebody's cousin's old horse walking slow, stubborn down a trail. I thought I'd marry one of these girls eventually. But by the time I had the staying power, the girls and the horses were gone. So was everything else. That whole first year on the ship, I drained mountains, dappled sunlight and leaf shadow, screaming cicadas, the way the evening wind cools your sweat if you hike high enough up the ridge. Then it just stopped, and there was only the ship. Flat wall panels and bright finished screws under LED lights. The dull echo of voices day and night. When I get a break from the commissary, I turn on the full spectrum bulb above my bunk, that warm fake sunlight, and close my eyes. I whisper the names to keep from going crazy. A little prayer made of everything we lost. Coyotes and marsh hens. Red-shouldered hawks. Biliated woodpeckers and the long leaf pines. Titmice. Dark-eyed juncos. Speckled red salamanders in the Smokies. I picture them all. Not just the rare, but the everyday, the familiar ghost, dumpster crows and red-eyed box turtles, grasshoppers snapping their crimson wings open in a field, sharp-shouldered turkey vultures, how they'd ride the thermal updrafts, spinning high and slow, like they had all the time in the world. When I'm drinking, I pull the bear claw out of the bottom of my duffel, the dull hind claw of a problem male my boss shot years ago. I make myself say the Latin names of the bears over and over, a liturgy, the only one I have left. Ursus Americanus, Ursus Arctos, Ursus Maritimus, Ursus Tibetanus, Horriblis, Middendorfi, Kermodal, Cinnamomum, Floridinus, the dead, the holy, the not yet risen. All those winter dreamers left sleeping in the earth.
Look, you asked what we were like as people. I didn't tell you everything. Everyone I loved is dead, too. I'm good with numbers. But I get this nervous twitch in front of a crowd. I keep trying to pop my neck vertebrae, but it looks like I'm sticking my head out like a turtle over and over. I can't stop it. My neck hurts all the time from bending over the computers. I wasn't supposed to be team leader, is what I'm saying. The Oond blew up 3 of our ships before we cleared atmosphere. 2,117 people. One was the French president. Not the real president. He was the minister of finance or something before the Paris siege. Another was our lead scientist, Rebecca Caffrey. She had 2 degrees from MIT and another from Harvard, and she broke pencils when she was mad. And she was my ex-wife. Before the last wave in December, she asked if I wanted to try again. Maybe on the ships, I said. Just focus on the evac, Beck. We can't afford distractions. There are no heroes left, just survivors. Put that in your story. Rebecca knew how to talk to people. She was a president of her sorority, for Christ's sake. She would have been so good at this job. All the briefings and admin meetings. The French president's husband was on a different ship, and I don't know if anyone has hugged him yet. Rebecca would have. She would have asked him, "How are you feeling?" and meant it. The day she died, I twisted in my portside seat to watch the liftoff. Palm trees shrunk to tiny dots and disappeared. Sunlight glittered on the Atlantic, a sheet of gold. Last time anyone would see it. The Athena glinted 200 meters south, rising fast. We'd have to burn fuel to clear the Oond orbitals. Let the flank ships hit them with lasers, drop the boosters, and gather the fleet. Maybe on the ships, I thought. The first missile looked so white I thought it was a snowy egret. But what was it doing up so high? Then the fireball exploded, a pearly peach glow, like sunrise over Cape Canaveral. I still didn't get it. I don't know how I was so stupid. I pulled off my iPro and stared. I hope Beck is seeing this, I thought. She loves sunrise. And then, the burning pieces began to fall.
Thanks for listening to Chapter 4 of The Distance Between Stars, a sci-fi novelette and audio drama by me, Stephen Cavett. Today's episode featured Kaylee Weintraub as intrepid journalist Nikish Fromer, Brittany Ruthier as head supply clerk Amelia Shizeski, John Lofton as underemployed Marine Sam Wale, Dr. Joel Ying as lead scientist Denton Boyce, Dr. Joe Flowers as accidental pilot Alan Abernathy, and our amazing sound editor, John Cornelius. In the show, I voice Johnny Quarles, a writer who's actually named after my own maternal grandfather. But I've got a lot in common with Leland Hames, too. About 4 or 5 years before I wrote this, I moved down to South Florida, and I moved away from the mountains that I loved. So when I thought about what it'd be like, for some of us at least, the outdoor lovers, to be pulled into space and to be under those hard fluorescent lights, I got to thinking about my own grieving process, you know, of leaving my Appalachians. And that's where this liturgy came from, losing the peace of wild things. We've got one episode left of The Distance Between Stars. On the Stephen Cavett Presents podcast, you get the whole book for free. I'm not going to hide the last chapter behind a paywall, but I'm not going to stop you from buying a copy either. It's available now on Kindle Unlimited and in print at major booksellers, and we've got a link in our episode description. Join the mailing list at stephencavett.com for a heads up about the next book, The Uncertainty Principle, as jump tech Snap Arbuckle Jr. tries to save the only girl he almost loved from a space-time anomaly, and the vicious aliens known as the Und.